is Millie Gettega. I am one of Alan's friends, a pretty new voice to you, but we've decided to switch it up a little bit today, and I will be interviewing who usually hosts this show.
As you've just heard from the intro, my friend Millie hosts today's show and interviews me about my experience traveling in Eastern and Southern Africa. And we spend a lot of time, obviously, speaking about my experience in Burundi. And we talked about what shocked me or what surprised me when I went to Burundi earlier this year. And we talked about this economic situation in Burundi that we don't often hear about in our political discourse. And this is something that I've talked to a lot of people about, and a lot of people are always surprised by my shock at the economic situation in Burundi. And the reason is because this is the first time that I had gone in many years, and the first time that, you know, I had gone as politically active as I am now, and observed the situation in Burundi, both politically, socially, and economically. And I was surprised by how very little time we allocate towards talking about uplifting the average person. And so, because I don't have a point of reference, we pick up this episode at the time that I ask Millie about her parents growing up in Burundi and whether the poverty that they saw or experienced at that time is different from where we are. So I'm trying to make comparison as to whether we've made progress or whether we are still where we were from her parents' perspective. Again, I hope you enjoy the episode. Thank you very much. I want to pick up on that, on your parents, because one of the, when I was having this conversation, a similar conversation with a family friend of ours, and he said that my shock about the condition of the people in the rural areas was because I had never seen it. I'm wondering whether, from your parents' perspective, whether things have changed for the worse or have remained the same for people in their Ruguru.
So, I'll put it this way. I have a bunch of cousins that live in neighborhoods, say Mutakura, and things like that. And sometimes when I go to their places and you see one compound and it's like five families living there, it's like two people out of those five families that actually have a job.
Right.
Things are really, really scarce and bills are a lot higher. So I used to turn around to my mom and I'm like, what are these people doing here, right? Mm-hmm. But my mom's from a family of eight. Eight of them have 45 kids altogether. When you start adding all this up, there's not enough space.
So has life,
right, for them to grow up in the same conditions she grew up in.
Right. So the people
which were already pretty poor.
Right. But the people that are there now are
seeing a new type of poverty, which is urban poverty, to me is the most heartbreaking. And it's something that I saw a lot in Addis, because Addis is not a city that's really drawn on social class.
Right.
Like houses of very, very different classes are pretty much crammed up in the same areas.
Mm-hmm.
So from my window on the third floor in my house, I could see three houses that were living with no running water
from there,
right? So it's something that I grew up, I have a very good visual of what it looks like. And obviously I can't know what it's like because I'm not living that, but it's a very different view, and it's a lot more heartbreaking to see.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot harder to be numb to urban poverty.
Oh, because you've seen it.
Poor from subsistence farming, but then if you're coming to me like, oh, even that plot of land is really not enough to have more than one meal a day.
Right.
then it becomes a very, very different image, right?
Interesting.
To what's going on. And I think that's where the current party in power kind of won very early.
Right.
So even if you go back to the time when they were extremely popular, so the first elections in 05,
mm-hmm.
it was literally the dude was showing up in rural places, going out and giving avocados and shaking random people's hands. And
right.
It's like they're not elitist anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they understand what we're going through, you know?
Yep.
Whether that's true or not, obviously, could be debatable.
Right.
But whoever, wherever they were going, they were believing it. And mm-hmm. that's what made them extremely popular. And I think on the opposite side, how they started losing that popularity is that, yeah, he comes out, shakes hands, and does what, but it's not really changing day-to-day life for people.
Right.
The whole free giving birth and free schooling did change people's lives quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So as much as we're always there complaining about, like, oh my god, the level of education is worse, the hospitals are worse. Well, if you couldn't send your kid to school, you don't care about it. Like, obviously you would like the best education for your child.
Right.
But some school is better than none.
Then. Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's where you're coming from a different perspective. But yeah, it's really interesting. So you go in there and you see that level of poverty and you're like, wait, their priority is probably not this president guy.
Right. I'm glad that you get it because I could see why someone would be indifferent to the goings about the current president when you are in that economic situation. That's not your priority. That is not the thing that keeps you awake at night, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Unless you have some feeling that whatever would replace that system would bring a better outlook. And
But that hasn't... I don't think...
I feel that no one has gone around and made that argument to that everyday layman of our upper hills, basically.
I don't think that has entered our political discourse. I think we're still very much... And I think the guys who are in power now know it because they intentionally leave that in all of their arguments, right? Like when you listen to them talk about the new referendum, the third term, there's never been an argument that them being in power has been good economically for the people. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a strong enough opposition to bring in that conversation. And I don't know whether it's where we're at in terms of recovering from the civil war, in that we haven't matured enough to stop talking about, you know, who is in power, how many seats they have, you know, how long are they in power for, to now talk about the bread and butter issues, or whether it's something that our political class leave out intentionally because it can actually bring out alternatives quite easily. While when you talk about, oh, we brought peace, we brought this, you know, we're gonna be independent, those are semantics. You can't measure those. But if he were to talk about the economic situation of an average person, people can actually look in their own homes and realize, you know what, this hasn't helped us at all. So it's a question that I don't know whether it's one way or the other, or whether it's just that we are still a bit behind in terms of our democratic journey, so to say.
You know what, I think what maybe you're failing to see or is not really put forward enough.
Right.
Is how important that whole Arusha Accord was.
Right, right.
So that the point of that document was to be a starting point for us to start building our institutions
mm-hmm.
on all sides of democracy. So the three main institutions of our democracy.
Right.
It had our main issues in mind, right? So mm-hmm. the very blurry and weird and very contentious history the nation had. So it had something called that Vérité Réconciliation Council that was supposed to be put in place, that was supposed to be working on that, right? Nation building based on our contentious history. There was CNTB that was supposed to be put in place in terms of land, because obviously there have been obviously some clerical errors, a lot of crony capitalism, a lot of land that has been stolen or taken by mistake or by knowledge, I don't even know, from those people that had to leave the country so long ago and find a way to restitute that. There's also been a long debate on gender equity related to that land situation.
Right.
And everybody's just like, maybe we should keep gender out of it for now, because even brothers are killing each other for that. Like, it's the number one reason people die. Like,
right.
We might blame the government of whatever we want, but people are killing each other over land. Other things that Arusha came out with, like those quotas by now, if they had been pretty well respected, were supposed to be, like the ethnic ones,
right.
We're supposed to build trust. So if we're sure there's a little bit of everybody in all of our institutions, no one should be scared, right? Because mm-hmm. that fear has drawn people to do pretty irrational things.
Right.
So it was supposed to have built trust by now, and we were supposed to not need them anymore maybe by now.
Mm-hmm.
But now the fear has just skyrocketed again between the different groups and so on and so forth. So actually, I feel like the people who are pushing for us to go back to respecting that drawing board we started from,
mm-hmm.
to go from again, would at least bring us back to a debate that makes sense. Because from my time there, and I want to say I kind of stepped off of the debate a couple months after he got elected.
Right.
Because I was just like, wait, what are we debating about anymore? I don't even know.
Right. That's me. Time to time.
I just got lost with it. And then going there, so as I was saying, I have quite some family that's in Takura, Chuito, King, Gagara.
Right.
So, you know, neighborhoods that were quite affected by, you know, the protests and also the big backlash from the protests. No one from my family that I know participated, but right. like the level of fear and insecurity and, you know, lifestyle change was pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
Making it that by the time I got there, they were like, we're just glad we can go to work now. We're really glad our kids can go to school again.
Wow.
Some of my cousins that had teenage boys still had them live in other neighborhoods with other family members.
Wow.
Just because they were scared of profiling, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
But they were just glad things were calm again. They were ridiculously, I mean, the level of poverty is there. Security is not top notch, but, you know, it's better than burning tires outside.
Right.
And the police showing up at people's houses and taking people out all the time. So having all that toned down and the attention going to, I don't know, a whole bunch of important people shooting each other. You know, because by then they were targeting more Adolf and I don't know who else was. It was more the political class or people really involved in those things.
Right.
Than the profiling that was happening in those neighborhoods. So they were so glad about that. Then you show up at markets, one day there's this fruit, tomorrow there's that fruit is not there, one day there's fish, tomorrow there's no fish, one day there's sugar, tomorrow there's no sugar, you know, one day there's gas, there's petrol at the petrol station, another day there isn't. It was just like, what the who is going on here?
Right, right.
Zero consistency, and I just felt like the country was just eating itself slowly and slowly and slowly.
Right.
But it didn't feel like it was eating itself to implosion.
Hmm. Interesting.
Which made it even sadder, because I almost felt before going there that, oh, this stuff is gonna implode anyway because it can't last.
Right. Right.
Then I got there and I was like, wait, maybe this can last. You know, it can get worse for a long time.
Yeah.
And it was just really, 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 really heartbreaking. It was tough to swallow.
Yeah.
And things didn't work. And you would hear that now, you know, people who work, say, in a government office or whatever, you know, they're switching. One ministry is getting paid late this month, and then it's going to be another one the next month, and then another one the next month. And I'm just like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like, it's almost like a functioning alcoholic, right?
Like, I'm just like, wow, yeah. How do things work? And then obviously, corruption had gotten to a level where you're like, it can't be this easy, come on.
But it is.
Yep. I didn't feel like it was dead. When I got to the airport, it was just as lively going to town. It was okay. But I grew up on a pretty lively nightlife in Bujar.
Right.
And it didn't feel as lively.
When that's I went there. Yeah.
Though my first night out was on a Tuesday.
So oh, okay. That probably explains it. That probably explains it. No, but I think for me, one of the things, and this is in comparison, is that when you visit other countries,
mm-hmm.
you have a sense that they are on the come up, right? A lot going on. There's a lot of constructions. There's new areas that you hadn't seen before. But Burundi seemed to be at a standstill. So that's what felt different about the place. Even, you know, when I went to the airport, for example, in other countries, it seemed like there's a lot of movement between countries, mm-hmm. and you know, tourists coming in and visitors from all different kinds of places. And mm-hmm. when I got to Buja, it was just our plane that just landed from Kigali, and there was this. There seemed to be nothing else going on. So that's where I was coming from. It was like one of the last places I went to, where other mm-hmm. places they seem to be on the come up, and it's sad to see a place that's, you know, at a standstill or even going backwards somehow, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. So on that trip I was coming from, I did Addis, Nairobi, Mombasa. Bujumbura.
Right.
So all four cities are cities I had been to before.
Right.
And obviously, Nairobi being what it is, it's a pretty settled, like, well entrenched economy.
Right.
I wouldn't say it's growing ridiculously fast or whatever. It's just like good. It feels really middle income. Right?
Yeah. Like a mature, well, not mature, but maturing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Versus Addis, that's been growing.
Yes.
Very, very sporadically for, I want to say, 20 years now, where it's visible.
Right.
You know, it's not like, oh, you kind of feel it, you hear about it. You see it. Physically sensible.
Right.
So it's been 20 years and you just see it grow. And I always say to people, like, when we moved there in 92, Burundians were making fun of us. Of like, oh, why are you moving to that place where people are starving? Because that's all people knew from TV, right? The famines and Heal the World, Michael Jackson songs.
Yeah.
And you know, Ethiopia was pretty rough the first couple of years, but it was, you know, it's what it is. Right. I'm never going to complain about that place. But now it's just the beast that it is.
Hmm.
And it's just so fast, right?
Right.
And then every summer I keep going to Buja and it looks like a year ago. And it looks like a year ago for like 10 years.
Oh, that is the best description of Buja that I've heard.
I was just having a conversation about like the first time I went to Rwanda was in 2004.
Right. Oh, and now I'm sure.
And then that year I was staying in a neighborhood called Nyarutarama, which was still new at the time.
Right.
It was so called super bougie or whatever. And there was no water and no electricity. Everything was on.
In a bougie neighborhood?
Sorry?
In this bougie neighborhood?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
like,
wow.
We had a generator and a water tank.
Oh,
like,
wow.
There was no water coming in and no electricity for the whole week we were there.
Oh, wow.
Like, Rwanda was still so up and coming, right?
Right.
And then you go to Buja in 2004 and, yeah, it still looks the same. And then you go to Kigali. Well, I haven't been to Kigali in like 5 or 6 years,
right.
But yeah, 6 years ago, shit was just working, right? Like,
yeah.
Everything worked.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, maybe it's because I've seen the progress of not progressing, that I'm not so surprised with it,
I'm not so hurt
by it.
Right,
but,
right. I think for people that have seen it before, but I mean, aren't you hurt or surprised by the lack of progress, right? And I mean, you've experienced this like massive growth in, you know, Addis, you've seen the growth in, you know, in Kigali and other parts of the country, and even I'm sure Kampala, I don't have a lot of experience, I haven't been, but to see that even like Dar, like from what I've heard, there's a lot of progress that's been made. And for
us, you know what? The first time I went to Arusha,
right,
I was like, wait, this is the what largest city in this country? And it's still so, it really gave me a Buja vibe,
right?
It's tiny the same way, there's very few people, everybody knows each other kind of vibe, and whatever, but everything works.
Right. It's functional.
Like, it's very, very functional.
Right.
I understand it's a pretty international city, but whatever. Like, it's very functional. You go to Mochi, it's the same thing. So, you say Arusha is maybe full of expats. Go to Mochi, there are no expats there.
Right.
It's such a functional town. Like, you would love to retire there. It's just chill, calm,
right,
small. And I was just like, wow. Oh my god, this feels like an upgrade from Buja, like in terms of,
most places are an upgrade.
And a little, tiny little bit more sophisticated, but
right.
Moshi's like, I don't know, the sixth largest city in Tanzania.
Right.
I'm like, we're still not there. That's really bad.
this is where now my skepticism and all my hope went, because when you see it, and it also speaks to, you know, how much work it's going to take to get that place to a functioning state. And that whole country, I felt helpless.
Yeah.
You feel
tough, eh?
Yeah, you feel helpless. But I don't know.
So, do you feel like the debate needs to be recentered now at this point?
So I think. Sorry, I don't know if you finished your question, but
yeah.
But what I think,
yeah, go for it.
What I think is that I think the debate, so I go back to pre-2015, the debate we had, and obviously things have changed in 2015 with the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation we're having pre-2015 was not reactionary to who was in power.
Exactly, yeah.
It was a conversation about the people, right? The country, the place, how do we get it to move forward? Mm-hmm. But since 2015, I think politics and the third term and all of this, and in some ways, you know, it makes sense for it to impact our conversation. But I think we, especially for young Burundians, I think we need to have a conversation that is not going to be fundamentally changed by the political winds in Burundi.
I absolutely agree.
So that's the biggest takeaway, basically.
I feel like I've just been longing for a more constructive,
right,
and strategic type of conversation versus the angry and reactionary conversation that seems to dominate.
Right, right.
But at the same time, I also find that myself and anybody that I feel would like to engage in a more constructive and strategic conversation feels hopeless. I don't know how to, like,
it's true.
We don't know where to start.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What do you do? There's no, it's really hard to come up with a starting point.
It is, and that's what makes it difficult, because I and one thing that now, the comforting thing, which is really not comforting, is that throughout history, Burundi has been going through, I just finished reading, I don't know if, I just finished reading Small
Cat.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
I haven't read it yet, so.
Oh, what?
Yeah, I haven't.
Oh, okay. I'm very disappointed. I thought you'd have read it.
Are you unfriending me for that?
No, because I actually thought you would have already read it. And there's this one paragraph that sums up the history of Burundi. You know, he talks about how basically there's always these, what does he call them? I think he calls them like violent and destructive, like winds, like that are fermenting, that are just like waiting to happen, right? Like every year, or no, like every 5 years, like also. This just like fire, just like brewing, just ready to just like throw itself out there. And for me, it described, and obviously this book is set in 92, and it describes it, you know, that time, but it also feels very, very present, very real in today's, in what we're going through today. So I'm like, we still, you know, people still gotta leave, you know, hospitals still gotta be open, like people still gotta make money, despite of all of those things that are going. So I think, especially for us who still have a little bit more days, hopefully, on earth, the youngins, we need to definitely, I agree with you, start having that strategic conversation that is not dependent on the political going-ons in Abuja.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh well. Hopefully, we'll find something that works out. I wanted to ask also a little bit. So, you know how you were in Zimbabwe, seeing your wife, you know.
Right.
Reconnect and completely be in symbiosis with her homeland.
Right.
Do you have this longing of being able to share this with her and being able to have her hike with you somewhere in Naro?
Oh, absolutely. I think, I mean, yes. Yes. And I think it's going to happen definitely sooner than later. For me, I've gone to Zimbabwe several times now, and I've traveled around Zimbabwe, and for her to show me that, it's something quite special for the both of us. But obviously, to me, it always feels, it feels difficult for me that I can't do the same for her, and I know she wants to go and see where I'm from, see the people, and experience Burundi from my point of view. And the fact that we can't freely now do that, I mean, we can, but the fact that there's fear of doing that, it's unfortunate. But oh yes, I can't wait to show her around. Yeah.
Yeah, that must be quite a thing. Eh?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So, I also want to touch up a little bit on the whole traveling, working remotely situation.
For sure.
So I only hear this from travel bloggers going like, oh, why are you not traveling the world and really promoting this big bohemian style and just work remotely and whatever.
Right.
So want to have your take on this. So how was the process of you kind of being able to do that? And so given the time difference, what were the hours you were usually working? While you were there?
Yeah, yeah. So that's a good question. So one of my agreement with work was that I was to be available at least for half of the day that everybody's working. So
okay.
Yeah. So I started my day.
Oh, so that's really good.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So people could still reach me. I started my day at 1 o'clock, and then people could reach me, Edmonton time. So I was available, Edmonton time between 8 a.m. and 12 noon. So that's when I stopped working, because that was about 9 p.m. Zimbabwean time. That worked out well for us. And every time we had meetings at work, they were scheduled for before noon so that I could participate in those meetings.
That's wonderful. So most of your deliverables were some sort of reports? Is that
yes.
how it worked?
Yes.
What were your work activities, if you could describe them?
So the way that the best way to describe it is, I know a lot of times when you're working a 9-to-5, you know, you go to work, you have your to-do list, you have your big projects and your deliverables that you're working on, but you have some things you're working on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, there are some days that are busier than others, but you still have to show up anyway at work. For me, when I was working remotely, my orientation was different in that it was more task and project oriented. So when I went, I had three big deliverables that I was working on, plus every day thing. So on a day that I was done working on my big project and I didn't have to be in the office, I could just, you know, check my emails, making sure that if anybody needs me, they're going to see me. But that also meant that I could go out and, you know, go for a coffee, or I could go and do a hike or see something in the city while still technically working. So that's how I approached it, of course, with the conversation with my boss.
So did you have any unexpected challenges or unexpected easier things? I don't know how to come up with a word for that. For working remotely, did you find that your focus was better? Did you find that you were more productive, or did you find that...
Actually, you know what? The first half, I would say I was more productive than I'd ever been. I think part of it was... Or it felt like I was more productive. Part of it was because I obviously knew that, you know, I had to work harder to make sure that nothing goes wrong as a result of me being away. And so, like I was saying, that it was more task-oriented. If something came up at the end of my day, I still did it because I wanted it to get done, and I didn't want to be an excuse just because I'm traveling, I'm working remotely. So I think I was a lot more productive, especially in the first 2 months. In the last 2 months, I don't think I was not as productive, but I had actually gotten a groove. So it now started to feel familiar, just the same way as going to the office 9-to-5. So I start my work at 1, I finish at 9 or 8. If it's quieter, I'll go out and do something fun and then come back to it later. I think the biggest challenge was technology, because I still had to do meetings here. I still had to do some trainings that I do online. And obviously people have different technological, and no shade to you, technological skills, so sometimes it would be difficult to connect with others. The other challenge was internet and electricity. So you know, electricity sometimes, you know how Africa works. Sometimes you have no electricity for half a day. Sometimes the internet will be slow, and so it'd be difficult to connect with folks out here. But other than those, it was everything else went well.
So, do you think this is something you would attempt to do again and you would recommend to
people? I would absolutely recommend to anybody who is able to do it, to do it. One thing that I learned from this, actually, and this is something that there was one lady, like a Kenyan lady, gave a workshop the other day to young African professionals, was that a lot of times the way this came up is because I literally just asked. And when I asked, I didn't think that my work would, you know, accommodate something like this. But by asking, and when I asked, I had no, I didn't have the confidence that it would go through because it's just wild. But literally, just ask if you want something, because what's the worst that could happen? And I think as Africans, a lot of Africans, we're thankful to have a job, which is nice. But we don't really brag about like how well we're doing or ask for things that we need because our socialization, right? So what I want to say is basically the thing that I took away is from this was, honestly, if this is something that you think can be accommodated in your work, just ask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's not something I would go for, but good to know.
Oh, why not?
I think, a lot of people...
Why wouldn't you go for it?
Just because of the nature of my work.
Right, okay.
I do have to be present to go out and meet clients. Like, okay. It's just part of my job. So...
That makes sense.
That's just not possible. I do work remotely sometimes. I do work from home and so on and so forth, but it's just like it's a day. I have a doctor's appointment that's close by, or I feel sick and like I'm not sick enough not to work, but I don't want to be contagious at work, so I'll just work at home.
Right.
So those days I do give a good kick to productivity.
Right.
Just because you're not distracted by everybody at work.
Yeah.
Just because I'm too chatty, as you can notice. But I do also feel that the presence in the office actually helps in the team execution.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Oh, yes.
But... yeah, no, my main reason would be this would be impossible because I have to go out.
Because of the nature of your work. Yeah, and I mean, and I say that, like, if your work allows. So the way my work was set up is that I could do, say, 90% of my work remotely, and then 10% I needed to be there. And so that 10% of my responsibilities were transferred to someone else, to a colleague. So I was lucky that way, because that couldn't
stop. Wow, they were very accommodating. Yeah, kudos to your employer.
Yeah, they were quite nice. It was great.
Yeah. So that's one point I wanted to touch on. And then maybe a little bit. So did your wife come to Malawi with you? Or was it just Zimbabwe?
She didn't. So my wife was working in Zim.
Okay.
So she came with me to SA and came with me to Kigali. Even for Kigali, I was there for just over a week. And she only came for the weekend. So she, because of the nature of the work, she couldn't travel with me quite as much as I was traveling because I was, you know, working remotely. But she joined me to a couple of places.
So I wanted to touch a little bit on you two kind of being outside of your usual Alberta life, I guess, which hasn't really been the usual anymore, but how much has that exploration, like how much have you learned from viewing things in each other's point of view kind of thing? So has... Not how much, but do you have any examples of going like, oh, we were at the same place, she saw this and this point of view, I saw this and that, and I just learned from it. I don't know if I'm making a lot of sense.
I don't know if I am understanding your question correctly, but I'll try to answer to the best of my
ability. Maybe I'll try and rephrase this.
All right.
From your traveling together, or even you just being in Zimbabwe where she is, are there moments where you've had where... you're seeing things in her perspective from that particular travel, or she's seeing things in your perspective from that particular travel that has been a good learning experience for the two of you?
Oh, okay. So to answer that, is that my wife and I travel differently. So she's a more spontaneous traveler. Does not look up anything and just wakes up and wants to experience things. I am on the I want to get my money's worth, so I want to see as many things as possible, and my day will be scheduled to the minute. So when we were traveling, we tried to. What I learned, because we're newly married, we haven't done much traveling together. This is our first time traveling together. So the biggest thing was for us to learn each other's traveling styles and merging those, because as we have similar interests in that we want to do the same things, but we approach them differently. So when we went to South Africa, to Cape Town, for example, because I wanted to hike Table Mountain, which she loves to hike, and she loves mountains, so she wanted to do it. But she didn't want to plan, you know, the day and the time and the cab and the Uber and how we're going to get there. Mm-hmm. So she left the planning to me, which I enjoy planning, you know, planning things, making sure that I do all the things that I want to do. She just wants to be woken up and go. So... and so for that, we both were able to actually enjoy traveling together while at the same time enjoying the aspects of travel or the satisfaction of travel that we both value. So that was definitely one of the biggest learning experiences for us. And even Kigali was sort of similar. I was there before, she joined me a bit later. I was able to do and see things that I wanted to see. And then left some days for her where she can be spontaneous and say, hey, let's just check out this coffee shop, or let's go to the museum, of the genocide museum, or anything like that. So we learned.
That was a great growth experience.
Yeah, we learned how to travel together, actually. That's the best way to put it.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right, so that wraps it up for my question.
Well, this was fun.
I think I took on a lot of your time.
No, this is fantastic. We have a few episodes out of this, which is really great. So I'm excited.
Yeah, so, Alan, thanks for letting me take over your podcast.
I hope I answered your questions. I'm not used to being here.
And this was a lot of blind trust you put in me, so I'm very flattered. I hope I did not disappoint.
We'll ask the listeners.
And that you enjoyed our interview together, and that you'll find quite a bit to share with the listeners.
I did. This was fun. This was
I had fun. A blast.
Awesome. Well, Millie, thank you so much for taking this on. And you're a natural. I think you should definitely consider starting your own podcast.
Oh.
Yes.
I'm a podcast addict. I don't know if...
You know what? You get your blog, the blog that you review books, which, by the way, you haven't reviewed any books in a while. Because I follow
you
the
know,
blog.
That is absolutely true.
And make your podcasts about that. That would be one that I'll listen to for sure.
All right, well, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you.
And then we'll keep in touch.
All right, bye.
Thanks.